As we see the devastation in Nepal from that earthquake, it's understandable to think about the fault lines under our own feet. The Cascadia subduction zone off the coast, the Seattle Fault under the city, could both rattle our region at any time. Eric Holdeman knows a lot about these things. He's former emergency management director for King County and author of the Disaster Zone blog on emergency preparedness. Nepal is a less developed country than our own, so you might think that level of devastation we've seen there can't happen here.
I think that's what I call stinking thinking. Unreinforced masonry buildings will collapse. And we have those throughout our state and in the city and in the county here in the Puget Sound, and we don't even know where those are. So that type of devastation can happen here. And if you just look at Japan, which is the most prepared, they have a much better culture of disaster preparedness throughout their nation. And the types of devastation and what they had to deal with for their big event and the tsunami, it shows the level of devastation in even the most prepared nation. So don't be thinking that it only happened some other place. The dangers are there. We need to be respectful of them, and we need to become prepared not only as governments, but as businesses, families, and individuals.
We're going to hear more from Eric Holdeman about how to do that in a few moments. But first, in case you needed a reminder that these things can happen here, today happens to be the 50th anniversary of a 6.5 magnitude earthquake that hit the Northwest. The quake caused extensive damage in Seattle and the surrounding area. 7 people died. It could be felt as far south as Oregon and as far north as British Columbia. Knut Berger is the Mossbeck. He told Jeannie Yandel he remembers exactly where he was when the earthquake hit 50 years ago today.
The earthquake hit at nearly 8:30 in the morning, 8:29. And I was in elementary school, fifth grade. I was at John Muir Elementary, which is in the Rainier Valley. And I was at orchestra practice. And I played the French horn. And we were in the lunchroom of the school, which had a stage and was set up for orchestra practice. And we had our music teacher was a man named Mr. Bloom. And Mr. Bloom looked just like Richard Nixon. And as we were getting our instruments out, Mr. Bloom was standing on the little conductor's podium. He was tuning a violin, and that's when the earthquake hit. I remember it vividly. The earthquake felt like it lasted a long time. It wasn't just a little boom or shake, and I had felt those growing up. This one went on, and, you know, was it 30 seconds, however long it lasted, but seemed kind of like an eternity. People started screaming, the little kids. Mr. Bloom stood his ground on the podium with his violin and just kept saying, you know, be calm, students, be calm. I was a French horn player, I put my French horn over my head. I remember holding this brass horn over my head. I was standing, I wasn't sitting down. And I remember rocking, you know, you could feel everything moving. A crack formed in the ceiling of the auditorium. And, I don't remember whether we sat down and played and conducted our orchestra practice or whether we were sent to our classrooms. That part I don't remember, but the time that the earth was shaking is what is most vivid.
We're sort of laughing about these memories that you have, you putting your French horn over your head and all of these other things, but 7 people died. 30 people went to the hospital for injuries. You talked about that crack in the ceiling of the auditorium at your school. Seattle Public Schools alone had millions of dollars in damages. What do you remember about the city after that earthquake? Was anything different?
That's a great question because I really don't remember a lot. I mean, the conversation among everybody for a long time was, where were you when? And it was one of those moments like the Kennedy assassination or whatever. It's one of those things that you just don't forget. You don't forget what you were doing or where you were. And everybody had stories. People, you know, a friend of mine fell off the toilet. That was a very popular, and you can imagine fifth graders loving that story. I remember my mother telling me that my father was sleeping in that morning and she was awake. When the earthquake happened, she ran to the bedroom and my father in his pajamas and his hair kind of wild was standing in the bedroom doorway, kind of spread eagle, holding on to the door jamb there and yelling, here we go. And my father had been through the 1949 quake here, which was a bigger quake and also a very damaging quake. And I always liked that "here we go" comment, being sort of like, I've been waiting for this and now it's finally here. You know, like he knew it was going to happen again.
I'm talking with Knut Berger. He's the Mossback at Crosscut. He's also a frequent guest here at KUOW. We're talking about his memories of the 1965 earthquake. It was a 6.5 magnitude quake. It was felt up in BC. It was felt down in Oregon. It was felt throughout Western Washington. And you just talked about your dad's memories of that quake and that "here we go" image, your friend falling off the toilet during the earthquake in 1965. Over the years, as you've heard other people talk about this earthquake and where they were when it happened, what other stories stand out to you?
Well, there's really one big story that stands out, which is what happened at the Space Needle during that quake. The foundation of the Space Needle was built to double the current earthquake standard of that era. And one of the engineers who worked on it told me that it's the structure should stay standing even after a 9 quake. So that's very substantial. But it had not been tested. And there had been a windstorm in 1962. It had survived that. And on that day in April of 1965, there was a live television show, King Television Show Telescope, it was called, being filmed in the dining room. And it was a show for women, air quotes, fashion show and talking about that kind of thing. And I talked to people who were on the needle that day. And of course, when the quake hit, it began swaying. They had gone to a commercial just prior to the quake, so it wasn't broadcast on the air. People were quite calm, although apparently two Space Needle employees ran down the stairs and just never returned. It didn't do much damage, but I talked to a woman who was coordinating the fashion show, and the models were changing in the Space Needle elevator, and they could see the ground between the elevator and the structure as the needle swayed. And so they'd see kind of Queen Anne Hill on one side, and then it would be like Elliott Bay on the other side as they swayed back and forth. They only suffered a couple of broken bottles and a spilled aquarium. Some water splashed out. And to me, that was just one of those great quake stories. There was essentially no harm done. It passed with flying colors. And it turns out that one of the most kind of delicate-looking structures in the city is, in fact, very quake-friendly.
What do you think we learned from that earthquake in 1965?
It's really interesting. We as human beings don't think about quakes. We don't think about long-term consequences much at all. So I went down to the Pacific Science Center, has an exhibit from Pompeii. And you look at that, they had no idea that mountain could erupt. It hadn't erupted for 700-800 years. The memory of that was not particularly alive. They were growing crops on the side of Vesuvius. They didn't see it coming. But even if you do see it coming, like when we think about the Seattle Fault, which we didn't know about in 1965, we didn't really know about it until the early 90s, how damaging it could be. The Juan de Fuca Plate, you know, we've learned so much since then, yet we still live as if it's not going to happen or as if it's not true. And when you look at the statistics, the spans of time, geologic time and human time just don't match. To me, the science has advanced so much. We know so much more now about the Seattle Fault. We know how it's connected to other faults. We know where it runs. We know what kind of damage it's done in the past. We can see patterns now that we didn't see before. But I think before 1965, they just seemed like occasional random events. They weren't part of how we're supposed to think about the future. But we still have that tendency to put it out of our minds.
Knut Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut, telling KUOW's Jeannie Yandel about the 6.5 magnitude earthquake that happened in Seattle 50 years ago today. Remembering the 65 quake and hearing about Nepal makes you ask, what has changed in our earthquake preparedness in the last 50 years? Well, look around. You can see earthquake retrofits on many buildings and bridges. A major reason for taking down the Alaskan Way Viaduct is that it's too rickety to handle a major earthquake. Eric Holdeman is a former emergency management director for King County. He also blogs at Disaster Zone, a site dedicated to sharing information about the world of emergency management. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be with you and your listeners here, Ross.
So what have we done in this region since this 1965 quake to be better prepared?
In 1965, we didn't know about the Cascadia subduction fault off in the ocean, and it's certainly a significant fault system that runs from British Columbia all the way down to Northern California. And then even the Seattle fault, which is perhaps the most dangerous fault immediately in vicinity to the city of Seattle, is a crustal fault, and that wasn't discovered or understood until the early 1990s.
So we know more, but are we better prepared?
Well, if you go back in history, really on the government side, emergency management came out of civil defense. And in 1965, it was a civil defense focused mission with nuclear attack being the primary hazard, and this natural disaster piece would really have been very secondary to it. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, which we think of a lot, that wasn't established till 1980. So a lot of progress has been made.
Have we done enough retrofitting? There are a lot of older buildings here. Some have been retrofitted, but not all.
I think that's a huge issue, specifically for the city of Seattle, but all communities that have older buildings. I mean, Pioneer Square is just a great example. Unreinforced masonry buildings are the most likely to collapse. Our modern seismic codes weren't developed until about the 1970s. Anything built before that is really at risk of a danger of collapse. Pioneer Square could look a lot like Nepal.
What else stands in the way of us being prepared for a big earthquake here?
I would say citizens themselves. You know, a big change from 1965. I think you had kids coming out of the Depression who were adults there. They'd been through World War II. There was a lot more self-sufficiency in 1965. Today, we're consumer-oriented, service-oriented, and people don't cook. They don't have a pantry. They don't have just the normal supplies, whether they have a disaster kit or not. And people overestimate their capacity and capability to survive following a disaster. And, you know, the national message has been be prepared for 3 days or 72 hours. And that is a standard message, but I see that changing specifically in areas where you have big regional disasters, whether it's a hurricane or earthquakes. And a lot of emergency management agencies now say a week, and you know, the state of Oregon has gone to the point of telling people they need to be prepared for 2 weeks to be on their own. And I think a lot of people are prepared to be on their own for 2 hours.
Eric Holdeman, what do you think is prudent for us here in Seattle, given the earthquake faults that are here and the severity of a quake which could occur?
Well, I know people don't think about these types of things every day, but if you remember recently, there was a salmon truck that overturned, blocked traffic. I think it was 99, Highway 99 was closed. That's the type of traffic, even worse, that we'll have for months following an earthquake. So everything we can do to invest personally and then as organizations, public and private, and it's not just government, but individuals need to start becoming prepared. And if you haven't done anything, think about storing water, because you can live without food for a long time, but you need 1 gallon of water per person per day. And I know that adds up to a lot of water. Look at water filtration systems. A lot of people go camping, but start thinking about urban camping and really being on your own for 2 weeks.
How about a communication plan? All cell phones could be down. That could be really hard to get in touch with folks. What should one do for that eventuality?
One should not count on communications and our normal smartphone, cell phones working at all. It's one of the first things to come back up, but it could be days. We're not talking minutes or or hours. So a big thing for a communications plan is what you think about is, where are my kids? Where are my other family members? Are they okay? So you need to establish some reunification points. If you can't get back home, where could you go where people know you're going to be and assemble there? For us, my family, just for a house fire, we had the light post out front. And then if there was something we couldn't get home, we told everybody, well, go to the church. It was about 3 miles away. So you need those types of things. And we drive a lot in this region. You need to have a good pair of walking shoes, water. You need a disaster kit in your car because you could be walking 20, 30 miles to get home.
That's Eric Holdeman, former emergency management director for King County, author of the Disaster Zone blog on emergency preparedness, things to think about on the anniversary of that 1965 earthquake and after what we saw happen in Nepal.